Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Health Points, where we talk about anything and everything gamification health. And I'm Ben, and here with me is my co-host Pete.
Hi everyone.
And today we have with us Jamie Garcia, who is a senior lecturer in games development at the University of Technology Sydney, with a background in software engineering at Neuroscience Research Australia, primarily designing and developing, maintaining falls prevention video games and mobile apps for the Falls Balance Injury Research Centre. He's working on multiple health games and research projects, evaluating these games, and we're looking forward to exploring them on today's episode of Health Points. Jamie, it's fantastic to have you here.
Well, thank you guys for giving me the chance to join the podcast, and really excited to have a chat with you guys.
Wonderful stuff. Right, so we kick off. You are doing a hell of a lot in terms of health gamification and research. How did you get here? What was the passion that led you to where you are now?
That's a really interesting question, because there isn't a clear answer for it. It was a bit of a happy accident, I want to say. So as a kid, I used to play the Nintendo all the time, and I spent quite a bit of time in it, and mom and dad weren't quite happy about it. But yeah, I always saw a bit of a interest in technology, games, doing things that were interesting and people wanted to use in terms of engagement, technology, all of that. And when I came to Australia, I just met the right people at the right time. And I think I was probably the right person to join the team at the moment as well. So I met a couple of researchers in the University of Technology Sydney who wanted to explore the Nintendo Wii as a means to exercise and help the senior community to stay active. But they didn't even know how to plug it in, how to set it up. And I was like, I know how to do those things. So I volunteered to help the research lab. And that's why I call it a happy accident, because I just started working with these guys, and it was really exciting, really cool stuff. And I got the chance to participate in a whole bunch of experiments with health experts and the senior community. And I got excited to see how tech was helping them to stay active. And I was excited to see how a game that was not meant to be a exercise program was actually getting these people to move. So that's when I had the eureka moment, and I said, I want to do this stuff.
Brilliant. And so kind of the desire and drive to go and learn coding and software development, would that go in parallel, or was that a separate interest that kind of evolved?
It was a bit of a sequential set of things. So when I met all these researchers at UTS, I was going through the application process for a PhD scholarship. So I started working with them before I actually got admitted to the PhD. And I did my PhD in that specific topic, which was, I initially was designing games specifically for the senior community, because the games in the Nintendo Wii at the time were designed for kids. So when you put one of those games in front of someone over 65 years old, they might not know how to play it. And all these fuzzy things you see on the screen, like sounds and animations and flashy buttons, it's just confusing. So initially the project was about building one of those games, but at a much simplified version. And that kind of led to us meeting that people in Neuroscience Research Australia, because we were working on a similar project and they had a really strong clinical background and we had good coding skills. So we started collaborating on my PhD, and there was another PhD candidate at Neura, Neura short for Neuroscience Research Australia. And yeah, we just started collaborating. Collaboration went really smooth, really organic. We got a couple of papers out. And when I finished my PhD studies, there was an opportunity for me to join the Neura team as a software engineering and specifically building falls prevention games. So I was like, I tick all the boxes. I want to join this team. And I was able to contribute making cool games for them.
It seems like Australia is a bit of a hotbed for health gamification. We've had a fair few Australians come on the show before, and I know quite a lot of Australians working health gamification. Why is there such a culture around health gamification in Australia happening?
I'm not entirely sure. That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. I'll probably say Melbourne is a hub for gaming in general. There's a whole bunch of indie game development companies, and universities started creating courses for this stuff, which is relatively new. So if you think about this stuff 20 years ago, there was no games degrees at unis. There were computer science degrees with, you know, you can specialize in computer graphics or I guess related fields like that, animation, all those things, but there was no degrees in it. And all of a sudden the unis started offering, we actually have one at UTS, which I get the chance to coordinate. And that attracted people, and that attracted really brilliant students that saw the potential of using games for doing all this stuff. We actually have a new subject now in the games degree, which starts this year, and it's called Serious Games and Gamification Studio. And it's all about this stuff, how you can use games for a real purpose in life. I mean, aside from entertainment and all that. So I believe that might have a bit of an impact, having proper courses that are recognized. And it's just, yeah, I guess it's just the nature of gaming.
That's great news. And also it's fantastic to have the courses because it makes it easier to get buy-in for the apps, the games that we design, because there's a profession behind it.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a big support for making this go forward. That's great.
Yep. No, absolutely, yeah. And I think that's one of the main differences. For example, back in, you know, 15 years ago, you could learn how to make games, but they were not fantastic games. Whereas the students in our classes now, they learn to code games since day one, and they study for 3 years. So you get really good at not only coding, but designing. And funnily enough, one of the first assignments they have to complete is making a board game. It's a physical game, no coding. It's more about the game mechanics and what makes a game a game. How you make sure that people have fun and engage with your game.
Fantastic to hear. I mean, Pete, I know you lecture as well in the UK, as well as running kind of education globally. But what's exciting for me is that it still feels like quite a pioneering field. I know that we live it and breathe it all the time, but when we speak to other people, it still feels quite novel. But the idea that universities are starting to bring out the future gamifiers and the future people working in this industry, yeah, that's what's going to transform it in the coming decades. Really exciting to it. So, Jamie, you work on some really interesting projects around kind of ankle sprains, falls prevention. I've seen the one around pregnancy as well. Let's start with falls prevention, because that was kind of where you flagged up with me and Pete. So let's talk about Step Connection. Kind of, yep. Where did the concept come from? Why does it exist? What does a gameplay look like for an individual?
Yep, absolutely. As I mentioned, that was probably the beginning of my PhD studies. So initially, we started doing interviews with health experts looking at the Nintendo Wii and how the Wii was a tool that can be used for senior people to stay active. And in doing that initial study, we found that the Wii wasn't really a fantastic game. There was a whole bunch of issues related to usability, people being able to understand the instructions, understand the game objectives. And I don't know if you guys probably know the balance board that came with the Wii Fit. That was a bit of a hazard for older people. And some of the movements you needed to do on that thing didn't really correlate with what you see on the screen. Like, for example, there was a game where you're supposed to walk, but you're standing on that thing all the time. So what you do and what you see on the screen, there's no connection. And that was confusing for the senior community. So that's when we started thinking about how can we make a game that do help or does actually help people, and what's the most most important issue for the senior community right now? So we started a really boring process called the literature review, which most PhD students have to do, or anyone doing research have to do. And effectively, that means going through a whole bunch of academic papers and then finding the gaps in the academic literature. And that's when we found that falls is the main cause of fatality and the main cause of injury in the senior community. And it affects 1 in 3 people every year. So we thought, that's what we said, you know, this is what we need to fix. This is what we need to focus on. Let's make a game that makes people better, improves balance, reflexes, all of those things. So we tackled that issue. And that's how we started collaborating with Neuroscience Research Australia, because they're quite active in that space. So that's when we came to them and said, we have this game idea, and what do you guys think? They said, yeah, we love it. And at the time, the Kinect, the Microsoft Kinect, was brand new. It was just released by Microsoft. That was mid-2011. And it was just, again, perfect timing because the Kinect allowed us to do a whole bunch of things that no one could do before. So I don't know if you guys have seen the Kinect, how it works. It's effectively a camera with a whole bunch of sensors in it. And that camera can see your whole body and you can effectively track every part of your body at a really relatively high accuracy level. And all those movements can be translated into the game. So what that allowed us to do is to create a game where you don't have to attach sensors to people. You don't have to press buttons. You don't have to step on tricky platforms. You just move your body, point on the TV, and that's how you navigate the menus. And that's how you also play the game because you step in space. And I mean, that's a bit of the tech. In terms of the game itself, in doing the research and talking to experts, we learned that training the ability to take quick steps, it's all you need to do. And the best way to do that is to get, have a bit of a activity where people have to react to a stimuli on the screen or set of stimuli on the screen. So that's when we thought, what if we make a stepping game, but we make it a bit more fun? Because if we get people to simply step in space, reacting to a light, there's no fun in that. And that's when we came up with the whole game concept of you're an explorer, sort of like Indiana Jones, because they recognize the character from back in the 80s and the movies. And we told them, in this game, you have to take steps. And those steps will help you collect fruits. And those fruits will give you money. And if you make money, you can travel to different countries. So that's how we came up with the story. So it's a story where you're an explorer, you go to different countries, but you have to make the money to visit them. And that's how we kind of created a bit of a progression system. And that is what kept them going and playing with the game. Because there was always a goal to achieve. And the goal was always to unlock a new level, unlock a new game. In that new country that you visited, there was new music, new fruits, new rewards. So that's how the whole concept was developed.
I'm interested. How many countries are there to visit?
We initially had 16, and we thought that was going to be enough. And then after doing the pilot study, in less than a week, most people finished the 16 countries. So we took the game back and developed more and gave it back to them. So I think right now it's probably 60-something countries in the game, just to make sure they had something to play with for 3 months. That was the duration of the study.
That's why playtesting is so important.
Yeah, of course, 100%.
Sometimes the game is more successful than you think in terms of getting the activity you want. Fantastic.
I mean, playtesting is super important because the first version of the game was super confusing. We thought it was great, and we played it, and it was all based on the literature, and we played it in the lab, and everyone's like, yo, this is great. And we took it to a retirement village, and people got really confused. They couldn't navigate the menus. They didn't understand how to switch levels. They didn't get the whole progression system, and we had to oversimplify the whole interface so they could actually understand and play the game.
Oh, Jamie, I'm so in. This is like exactly my domain. This is fantastic. My mind is whirring. So one is, they finished the 16. How much gameplay was it to get to the end of 16 countries? How much duration of gameplay?
Let me do the maths. So the game was based on a clinical test that is used to assess the risk of falling. So effectively, what we did is a game that collects those same reaction time parameters, which allow us to not only keep this person playing, but also to assess if they're getting better, which is one of the key things in serious games, evaluation as people play. So the game, every level took about 3 minutes because we didn't want this each level to be too much. Exertion was a big deal, so we didn't want people to get exhausted from playing one level. And songs don't last that long, so that kind of limited how long the level could be. So we found a whole bunch of royalty-free songs, and we put them in the game, and we found songs that sort of related to the countries, and the same goes for the fruits. We did a bit of research on what country produces which fruit. So that's how the whole game was created. In terms of how long it took, the progression system needed each person to play at least 3 times each level. So, So that's what you needed to unlock the next one. And as you collect the fruits, you get money. So effectively what we said is, hypothetically, we know one person will take between 1 and 2 seconds to get one fruit or react to one of the stimulus on the screen. So if we put 30, that equals, you know, a couple minutes. So realistically, what we needed people to achieve is, say, get $100 so you can move to the next level. That means if you play the same level 3 times and in each play you get the 30 objects that you're supposed to collect, you get the fund, you get the money that you need for the next one. And there was a bit of a, you know, rewarding screen that every time you achieve that, and there was like a passport and a stamp that it goes, good job, you can go to the next level. So yeah, people could play as long as they wanted. We'd recommend the 20 minutes 3 times a week. They could just play 3 minutes if that was the minimum, or they could play a bit more if they wanted to.
Oh God, Michael, so many questions coming through. Right, so the nostalgia element, the Indiana Jones, I completely agree. We found that in a research project I'm on right now, in that we're doing very basic laptop webcam games, and what came through in the types of games that people were interested in were the like 1970s, 80s Atari-style games, and that was because of an element of nostalgia, but the benefit of it is that there's minimal onboarding time because actually it's a well-known game mechanic in how you play the game. So completely get where you went to Indiana Jones as a kind of basis and concept. Why did you decide on a points-based game and the narrative elements to it? Where did you take where was the idea for the game mechanics that underpin it? Where do they come from?
It was a mix of meeting with actual people, like part of the target audience. So for making that game, we did a whole bunch of focus groups, and we had initial prototypes, you know, the basic white screen with some character, and we had them play with that and got feedback. And something we learned from looking at what they said, because sometimes, you know, we gave them surveys and questionnaires and they filled it up, and often they don't say paper what they actually mean, because it's the first time they see tech like this, and they go thing and they say things like, this is fantastic, Jamie, this is the best thing I've seen in my life. But when you look at them play, you can see a frustration in their faces, or you can see that they're not engaged, or sometimes they don't show up to the follow-up meeting. So you need to read those signs. And in doing that, we learned that the senior community really enjoyed the concept of traveling and going places. And in some cases, some of them were not allowed to travel anymore, or some of them just the health conditions they had at the time prevented them from going places. So the concept of being able to visit other countries was quite appealing to the focus groups that we had. And I mean, this is the mix of, you know, this is the interesting thing with serious games. It was a mix of making something appealing for the audience, but also making something that achieves health outcomes. So the second part of the game design was what helps these people reduce falls. And the quick step training, that's how we sort of combined the two ideas. We need something that makes them engage or keeps them engaged, and the whole concept of traveling is one of those. And but also we need these people to take quick steps in place. And that's how those two ideas were combined.
Okay, I want to go into the stats and results in just a second. One of the things around co-design is what you just said, the acknowledgement and recognition about someone not showing up to the next focus group, or these kind of subtle non-verbal cues when someone's engaging with it, no matter what they told you. There's no book on this. So over years of co-design and co-production, like kind of picked up these kind of things as I go along. I really think for new people coming into co-design, co-production, iteration, there needs to be more support and training with these little things you're picking up that I've picked up with so many researchers and designers out there have done. I think there is a co-design manual that's needed, but like the real world co-design manual, not kind of step-by-step theory, but it's so good to hear you say that. Right, let's get into it. What did the results show you? What that came out in the evaluation?
So we look at the project from different angles. We're interested in people. Did people use it? Did people adhere to, I don't want to say therapy, because that's when it kills the fun, but did people adhere to therapy? Did people use the thing the way we expected them to use? That was one of the angles. Second angle was, did people have fun? Because one thing is complying, because the doctor says you have to do the thing. The second thing is, did you actually enjoy it and did you play it because it was fun? And the third angle is, did these people get better? Did they get faster? Did they achieve the improvement that we were expecting? And it was a huge analysis. And I'm happy to say that we got positive results in all of them. So people did adhere to the thing, actually more than what we expected. And as I mentioned earlier, they were meant to play those 16 levels for like a month. And they, a lot of them completed it in a couple of weeks. And we actually had to rush and develop more content and give it back to them just to keep them play, engaged with the whole 3 months. There was a couple of participants that actually got emotional when we took the games away, because they said, this became part of my routine. I get up in the morning, I make a cup of tea, I play the game, I feel energized, I go and talk to my friends. This game kind of gives me the energy to get out. And you guys are taking it away from me. Why are you doing that? I mean, it was just, you know, the end of the study and we needed to get the equipment back anyway.
That makes a lot of sense, though. There's a lot of people that start the day with a game routine. I know tons of, what are we calling them in this? Oldies? I've heard you say it. Who start the day with a Wordle, right? And that's part of their routine before they go off and do something else. And isn't it great that it could be an exercise-based one? That's what I like about what you said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was surprised to see that they saw a game, which is, you know, it's a thing. They saw the game as a companion, as, I don't want to say someone that was with them, but they saw it as part of their life. And that was quite an interesting outcome. Also, I mentioned that, you know, just to give you guys a bit of context, we did it in a retirement village. So they know everyone, and not everyone put their hand up for the project, but those that did kind of created a separate group organically. So I started chatting about the game, and all the residents in the village started to get a bit jealous that they were not part of the VIP club that plays games in the mornings. That was an interesting social sort of dynamic happening there. So from the adherence point of view, people did play the game a bit more than what we expected. We actually had a couple playing the game, because most of the people were independent living seniors. There was a couple, and they actually competed against each other a little bit. And they used to ask me questions like, Jamie, who's doing better? Can't tell you. Jamie, is it me? I know it's me. Can't tell you, but yeah, it's you. So I guess, yeah, from the usability point of view, people didn't have issues using the game, because we actually built a sort of system to collect data, not to invade their privacy, but to see what buttons they press in the game, how they did with each level, all the actions they did inside the game. So we were able to monitor that without having to look at them. And we noticed that the progression system was used the right way. They went through all the levels in the right way. We actually noticed that some people started playing level one just to warm up, which is the easiest one. And then they moved back to the one they left off last the day before. And then from the clinical perspective, we also did a whole bunch of tests in the village. So we gave them the game for 3 months. Every 4 weeks, I will visit them and run a whole bunch of tests. Every session will take about an hour and a bit. So it was a combination of motor skills and cognitive skills that were assessed. So we wanted to see if the game made the brain faster, if they were able to solve more complex problems aside from all the physical benefits. From the physical point of view, we noticed improvements, like huge improvements in the first month. Everyone got really fast. They improved reaction time quite a lot in the first month. From the first month up to the final one, there was tiny improvements, but nothing too significant. So I guess that's one of the things we learned from the game. It makes you better, but it's not like the improvement is linear or exponential. You get really good at the beginning. Once you finish the first month, there is only so much the body can do. And we can't expect people to, you know, react to take a quick step in less than a second. Like physiologically, we just can't. The body doesn't do it. So we actually pushed people to the best they could, and they stayed in that level. when they finished the study, we took the equipment away. We let them live the life again for a month. We visited them at the end. That was the follow-up interview. And we noticed that the improvements were still there. They were still stepping faster. They were still reacting to all the stimuli on the screen. From the cognitive perspective, we didn't really see huge improvements, or at least we didn't get improvements that were statistically significant. So we couldn't say, yes, the game works. You know, it makes your mind better. We noticed tendencies for improvement, but nothing we can claim as, you know, this fixes that.
So with that, really interesting in terms of the speed of improvement and the plateau of it. Does it matter if it plateaus at that point? Was it still a meaningful or significant improvement that as long as it was maintained, that was sufficient to reduce the risk of falls?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because falls prevention, or if you look at falls prevention from the reaction time perspective, which is how fast people can react to a hazard, a tiny difference in your reaction time, it's a huge difference in the impact of the fall. So if you're able to improve 200 milliseconds, that will prevent you from falling. And those were the kind of improvements we noticed. People, instead of taking second and a half to react, they were doing in 1.1 seconds. That tiny difference is what separates fallers from non-fallers. So being able to react to the thing really quickly is what stops the fall from happening. And the game was able to achieve that in all the participants.
So playing a bit of devil's advocate now, the Kinect system's been around for over a decade, and interactive computer vision games has been around kind of communally accessible with affordable technology for a decade as well. Clearly, you've been able to develop games which have been really well taken on, great usability, great satisfaction levels. Why isn't it everywhere? What are we missing? Where is the silver bullet of adoption at a global scale?
Yep, I'm with you on this one. That's always been the question I ask myself every day in the morning. What I think the problem is people don't take games seriously. So if you go, and this has happened to us when we apply for grants, every time we say we're making a game for, as soon as they see a game, nah, they don't take you seriously. That's one. Second one, the cost of technology. So all these interactive games, they are expensive. And that was a bit of background. When I finished my PhD, I tried to turn my game into a product. And I actually had a chat with the Ministry of Health, and I spoke to a institution that ran a program across Australia, which is all about falls prevention. And we saw the opportunity for that program to take the game as part of the program. But when we did the maths, we realized that it was too expensive. And just to give you guys some numbers from 10 years ago, having the Kinect with a computer and a game costed $1,000. And if you need a business behind it, like if you want to establish a business that is sustainable and can operate and can develop more games and keep updating the thing, you still have to make money on top of that $1,000. So the cost of getting a client, and I'm using quotation here, was higher than the income you can get or the profit you can get from that client. So creating a business out of that was challenging. The tech was too expensive. And if you go to a retirement house and you tell all residents, you're going to have to spend $1,000 for a game that will keep you active, but you know, it's $1,000. They'll be like, nah, thank you, not interested. So that's one of the issues. Tech, it's expensive. I guess the stigma of games not being a serious thing. And this is my third point was going to be the senior community. They're not that tech savvy. That's changing because the people I met in my PhD days almost 15 years ago, they didn't have a lot of computer literacy. Like they didn't grow with computers. And when they left the workforce, computers were it wasn't a thing for them. Whereas the people finishing, like retiring now, and I could, you know, my mom, my dad, they're almost 65, 70 now. It's a whole different generation. They actually use computers at work. They both have devices. They have iPads, tablets, mobile phones. They have a Chromecast. They know how to put Netflix on the TV. It's a bit of a shift in the audience. So going back to your question, why isn't that being used? The generation from 10 years ago, they were scared of technology. The generation of today, that might be a bit of a change. That might, yeah.
I hope your mum doesn't mind you outing her age on in public. I've also
No, that's fine. I didn't say to all this.
I'm not like letting Pete get a word in edgeway on this episode. So, what, in that case, what is next for older adult gamification in terms of health management and rehab? I want to go into the other games you're doing. I want to go into the other research, but I want to kind of close off this part of Step Connected. Where do you think older adult gamification is going in rehab and health and well-being?
I think for this to be successful, it'll have to be, it has to use things that people have in the house. Most adults or older adults have mobile phones. I think that's an opportunity. The challenge is developing a game that can track your body and can take a lot of measurements to, you know, do the whole evaluation in the background accurately. And the challenge with phones is that the screen is too small. So if you put it away, they can't see it. Probably smart TVs might be an opportunity. Smart TVs were not a thing back in, you know, 2010, 2011, when I started my PhD. That's an opportunity these days because a lot of people have smart TVs. So you connect, those TVs are effectively computers. So if you can develop apps for those TVs that can do a bit of the tracking or can, you know, deliver exercises, that's an opportunity. Yeah, I think what we need to change is the tech has to get a bit cheaper and it has to get to the point where anyone can just get it. And using existing devices is probably, it's probably the way to go.
Okay. Thank you very much for that kind of like nice end to Step Connection. Right. I want to move on now into the current project you're working with pregnant women in terms of being active in early stages of pregnancy. Again, opposite end of the life spectrum. Where did that come from? The idea, the concept, the project you're working on now?
That one I can't claim as one idea of my own. So I actually have colleagues in the Faculty of Health and I'm in the Faculty of Engineering and IT. And given that serious games can be applied to a whole bunch of things, I have collaborations with different faculties. And health is one of the strongest collaborations we have. And yeah, it was just a coffee chat with one colleague who said, Jamie, what are you guys working on right now? And I said, well, we're making these games for falls prevention. So she's like, ah, cool. I'm actually working in all these pregnant women exercise programs and all that. Do you think we can use games for that? Yeah, I think we can. So the whole concept sort of came up from that coffee chat. So again, I'm not the lead investigator on this project, but I guess my role is to provide advice on game tech, and we're actually developing a game as well. So the project has two components. The first one is, let's see what the Nintendo Switch can offer to pregnant women as an exercise tool. And we have a PhD student doing all the heavy lifting for that. And a spin-off from that project was, okay, we've seen what the Switch can do. We know what the Switch cannot do. What if we make our own game? And that's also happening at the same time.
So by your own game, do you mean you're doing the tech as well?
Yes. Yeah. So we're trying to get all the lessons we learned in the falls prevention game, Step Connection. And I was a big fan of the Kinect, but Microsoft stopped building the Kinect in 2017. So it's 6 years ago or a bit more. And yeah, one of the lessons we learned is that if you want to use the Kinect, you need a powerful computer next to it. And all of that is just going to add costs. So let's go with an approach that is, you know, as I said a few minutes ago, let's use tech that people have in the house. How can we get these pregnant women to exercise using devices they do have in the house already? That's when we came up with the idea of using webcams and laptops and building a game that does the whole body or skeletal tracking using a simple webcam. So that's when we ask our new friend AI to help us with that. So we found a AI. It wasn't a plugin really, but let's say it was a plugin, or it was a component that was able to get the full body picture and get joint locations from there and turn that into things we can plug into the game. So we found a way to track bodies without using a Kinect. We kind of built our own Kinect. Problem with that is you have to have a okay-ish computer, because a lot of the processing uses a lot of CPU power, or GPU power to be more precise. But if you put that aside, we found again we were able to make a game that does full body tracking and works on a laptop and delivers safe exercises for pregnant women.
So, like I say, what's the objective of it? What's the ambition? What's the aim of the project and technology?
So, the project started with, I guess, the main aim at the beginning was weight management in the early stages of pregnancy, because that's an issue. And there is a whole bunch of complications that can come from being overweight in the first weeks of pregnancy. Like, even the child can have issues with that. I'm not an expert in that thing, so I probably won't get into the details. That was one of the main motivations. Helping these people stay active, helping these women stay active, and helping them with their weight management. We sort of moved away from that because there was some ethical complications there. So we just did it as just a way for you to stay active and healthy and exercise in a safe manner while you're pregnant. Because again, that's a bit of an issue. You can just go and do the things that you did before, because now you have a baby inside you, and there's exercises that you can't do, like you shouldn't do it. It'll compromise the whole thing. So that's when we, step one was, let's get a Nintendo Switch. Let's get the Ring Fit game, which is the exercise thing that comes with the Switch these days. And we started looking at all the exercises and all the mini games in that game. And we had experts in exercise physiologists and maternal care and the midwives and, well, me. And we started looking at kind of like mapping what exercises were doable and what benefits were in each of those exercises and what exercises were a no-no. And we kind of went through that list and kind of created a customized program based on that. And then we had the eureka moment of, now we can do body tracking without the Kinect. We have all these exercises. What this tech will let us achieve? What can we achieve with that body recognition? And that's when we make a list of new exercises that became game mechanics. And again, we created a story and we did focus groups. That was in the middle of COVID, that made it a bit challenging. So we made focus groups with pregnant women or women that had been pregnant recently, or women that were about to get pregnant. And we created a game concept that, again, was appealing to them, but also incorporated the exercises that were prescribed by the experts.
Now, I'm intrigued, how many exercises, like, are you able to work with on this?
Quite a few, actually. And most of the exercises are upper body, lower body, but not so much of the core, because you don't want to mess with that. And some of the exercises we couldn't include require people to get on the ground and have a position that we just couldn't track. But most of the exercises are, doing things with your upper body, but no heavy lifting. You can use a bit of...
the TheraBand, yeah.
A resistance band, yeah. Or something.
Yeah. Yeah, those, just to put a bit of resistance. But we avoided things, anything above your head increases your blood pressure. We don't want that. So we avoided all of those. But it was, mostly exercises that you can just do yourself.
Yeah, so again, not an expert in this area. I know gestational diabetes and things around kind of weight management early. It's a challenge and needs to be something to be, there needs to be more support around it. But maintaining physical activity during pregnancy, and importantly, hopefully to promote that post-pregnancy, is really important. Within my role in Good Boost, we're working on an aquanatal program at the moment, the swimming pools, for what we do. But again, it's a real shift from where we normally work, which is older adults. So what I'm really curious about, Jamie, is just such a similar journey. So where has this been led by, and how is it? Because we've done a lot of work with midwives and natal-specific physios, and importantly, expectant and recent mums. How has it been through that process of you in terms of the co-design with the end user?
It was interesting because we didn't want to make assumptions about women, and that's a gender these days, a bit of a tricky one. So we work closely with the midwife, who was actually, I mean, she's a senior lecturer, my colleague, Deborah Fox. She's the person leading the project, and she actually found the participants. So when we came up with the initial design idea, we didn't want to go with the whole, let's put rainbows and unicorns and make it all pink, because that's what women do. We avoided all of those assumptions and all those misconceptions and stereotypes. Funnily enough, when we put the game in front of them, they wanted the rainbows, they wanted the pink thing, they wanted the unicorns. So, yeah, that got a little funny anyways. But I guess the final concept that came from doing the co-design sessions and talking to these women is that they wanted something they can care for or care about. So we came up with the concept of you actually manage a village. You live in a village. There is a massive egg, and the egg was a bit of a representation of your baby. So as you do things for the village, like picking fruits or doing gardening or doing simple activities that were appealing to them, and they actually suggested those activities. As you do those things, the egg gets bigger, the village gets bigger. And that was the concept that they found appealing, or that was the concept. They started making suggestions, and we, you know, had a bit of a brainstorming session with the game designers and kind of prototyped things and had a second session and showed them what we created. And they started to get really excited about the idea of the egg and the idea of doing all these things that it's about providing care. That was the concept that was appealing to them. And that's why gardening was a game component, or cooking was a game component. So the challenge was, how do we get gardening a thing where you move your arms this way? Like, how do we incorporate the exercises in something like that? So that's when it got a little that's when it got challenging or interesting. I mean, challenge equals interesting. And again, the game's not fully finished. We're still working on it. But so far, they seem quite happy with what's been built.
It could go on for hours, Jamie. there is one thing I want to go into before we kind of close out the episode today. Is so we speak to a lot of work people. I mean, that's the whole point. The health points, but one of the things that keeps coming up is around regulation and research, and the challenges and nuances of health gamification compared to a drug or a traditional medical device, which is usually relatively static in like the biochemical formula of a pill or the actual kind of biomedical device of a rehabilitation device, whatever it is. Within gamification, like with all games and with all apps, there is ongoing iteration improvement to improve engagement and outcomes and statistics. The challenge being is the existing format of regulation and research means that what is submitted 5 years ago, 3 years ago, a year ago, may be completely different in terms of the gameplay, but that was not the purpose, that was not involved in the research project a year ago. What needs to happen in terms of regulation in thinking about that, how fast-paced the development and improvement of game mechanics within what you've explained, narrative, hugely within both the games that you described today. Where do you think the future lies within health gamification and regulation?
That's a tricky one. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I guess the challenge is what I mentioned before. People don't take games seriously, and there has to be a shift in that mentality, because games can be powerful, and there is evidence that they do work and help you achieve a whole bunch of things aside from entertainment. What needs to happen? I mean, yeah, this has been me a bit of dreaming, but what needs to happen is that they take it seriously.
Um, In that case, then I think within kind of rehab and physiotherapy, I've seen a real shift in paradigm and thinking in the past few years. The view was the quantitative is king and kind of RCT is king, when actually is the recognition these are complex interventions with complex human beings, which are multifactorial problems, and as a result, qualitative research is actually incredibly valuable, if not maybe more valuable in some cases. Do you think that perception shift needs to change as well with health gamification?
100%. And I think something that can make a difference is the big game makers. Once they start incorporating games for health, that will change things. And I mean, you know, Nintendo, Sony with the PlayStation, Microsoft with the Xbox. Once they start putting serious games in it, I mean, they do have games like these games like The Biggest Loser for the Xbox or the, you know, Ring Fit for the Nintendo Switch, but they're not games targeting an older audience and they're not games targeting a specific health outcome. It's just exercise games in general. Once they start developing games where the main goal is to help, say, an older person reduce the risk of falling, that might make the shift. Because if you see that the big players are going that way, people will follow. Whereas if a indie game development studio does it, it's like, yeah, keep going, guys. You know, that's fun. That looks cool. But no one takes you seriously. So, and I think that's been one of the biggest challenges for us as well. We've spoken to Microsoft. We've spoken, not to Nintendo. We've spoken to Microsoft, and we had a team in Singapore who looked at the game. And they were like, yeah, looks good, but no, thanks. That's probably what needs to change. Because the evidence is there. Yeah,
that makes
the evidence
a lot of sense.
Sorry, you go.
I think it makes a lot of sense because like health gamification apps are pretty popular and getting quite a lot of coverage and use. And I guess that's because they're on a platform that is accessible to everyone. Whereas what we're talking about here is specific games through the mass gaming platforms. I think that's something worth targeting.
Yeah. I think that is something worth targeting, Pete. Maybe there's a campaign we need to pull together on somewhere over the next health gamification conference. Jamie, it's been so good to have you on. We could have gone for absolute hours. I know I'm going to follow up with you. But to talk about things like nostalgia as a shortcut to onboarding with older adults and the role of games that can improve and maintain old adults' reaction time, which can be the difference between a fall and staying upright. And importantly, the value of playtesting, prototyping, iteration, and reading the less subtle feedback signs when you're working with participant co-design. Jamie, it's fantastic to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. And, you know, it's been refreshing to have this discussion. And all the questions are very interesting. And they actually got me thinking. And yeah, I think there is really cool stuff coming from this. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
It's been great, Jamie. And it's been fun to see Ben swept away with his enthusiasm for it too.